Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and what's next. It's a show that asks questions and peels back the layers of our average everyday experience and goes beyond scratching the surface. We interview people doing incredible things who are making a difference around the globe. Join me as we listen in and get one step closer to understanding that big ideas shared create collaboration, collaboration can inspire community, and communities create social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
My next interview is with Ryan Suffern. He's a documentarian. He's a filmmaker. He has just released a new film in the States, coming to Canada hopefully soon, called Finding Oscar, findingoscar.com. You can find out more about it there on release dates and so on. We talk about a little bit of everything here on Face to Face. I think you're going to really enjoy the conversation, but more importantly, you need to get out and see the film. Going to be coming to Amazon as well, I think, sometime in July. We talk about the code of silence. We talk about victims and about something called real justice. What does that even mean? And about the difference between something, you know, being maybe transactional versus transformational. We talk about truth and evidence and justice. We talk about memory and about putting a human face on some of these issues and why it's so important to speak to it, to tell these stories, why these stories need audiences. And I think there's so much here for everyone. So please do stay tuned for a really interesting conversation. And also, more importantly, too, just about how to maintain a sense of realism, but optimism at the same time. So coming right up, Finding Oscar is the film. Don't forget davidpecklive.com for more information about my own podcasting. Once again, coming up on 300 interviews. It's coming soon. I don't know who it's going to be yet, but we'll let you know. And you can find out more about my speaking and writing and so on there. And if you want to support what I do through Patreon, please do. And don't forget rabble.ca for other interviews as well. And right now, Ryan Suffern coming up on Finding Oscar here on Face to Face.
Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest today from somewhere in the United States. I have no idea where that is. It's a big country, I've heard. Ryan Suffern is here with us today to talk about his new film documentary called Finding Oscar. Where the heck are you, Ryan, is the question we really want to know the answer to.
I'm in the southern western tip here in Los Angeles.
Oh, very nice. And good weather today for you?
It's another beautiful, sunny, 70-degree day here in Southern California.
Nice. And I can safely say here in Toronto, it's not snowing. So take it from there.
You're almost through the dark tunnel of the winter.
There. That's right.
One more snowfall before June?
Oh, man. I sure hope you're wrong about that. Maybe.
Well, I'm from Chicago.
Oh, okay.
Originally. So I know the feeling.
Well, we share a fair amount of snow actually through most of the winter, it seems to me, or at least pretty close anyway. Well, listen, first right out of the gate, congratulations! What a beautiful film! What a tragically beautiful film!
Thank you. I think that's probably the best way to put it.
So you kind of bookend the film, it seems to me, with something that we're all pretty familiar with, you know, and I can't remember exactly if it was crocheted or not, but it was a framed picture drawing on somebody's home wall that said, "Home is where our story begins." And yep, and you kind of bookend the film that way, it seems to me. Can you talk a little bit about that? Clearly a very intentional choice on your part.
Yeah, so, I mean, the context of that little framed crochet piece is in Oscar Ramirez's home in Framingham, Massachusetts, which is a suburb of Boston. And we see it in the context of, at the beginning of the film, of this kind of opening breakfast scene where Oscar and his wife, Nydia, though you don't really see them, you hear the adults off camera, but you're seeing his family, his four beautiful children, kind of coming to the kitchen table as his dad is making them breakfast. And really, you know, we're trying to infuse right from the get-go that even though this is a story about a massacre, and really a larger story about a genocide in the Americas, there is hope to be found in it, and that at some point we are going to come back and it's a film called Finding Oscar, and we're going to find him. And this is the life and the family we're going to find on the other end of that journey. So there's a very, I think, pragmatic reasoning on our part to really try to infuse the story right from the get-go with that hope, and then go and tell what is really an epic search, decades-long search for this little boy, this little survivor who is now a man and father of four, that, you know, he's the needle in the haystack that they're looking for, starting in the jungles of Guatemala and ending in the suburbs of Boston.
You know, it's really interesting. So we do find Oscar.
We do, yes.
It's really interesting, you know, I was saying to somebody just recently, and it might have been in another interview that I haven't actually published yet, but there seems to be, for me, I'm coming up on 300 interviews, and it seems like there's a theme. And if I had to draw one out, there'd probably be three or four, I would imagine, in some of the conversations that I've had about, you know, so many different things. I mean, the theme, I guess, is social change, I suppose, for Face-to-Face. But home actually seems to be something we keep coming back to. So, you know, this idea of a space, of a presence, of a family, of being connected, of being included. Maybe it's not immediate family. Maybe it's a book that you're writing. Maybe it's a film that you're making. But it's this idea of feeling and being included. And I couldn't help but get that sense at various points throughout your film, that this is what it was really about. Yes, this is a mystery to be solved. This is about justice. This is about human rights and so many other things. But ultimately, it's about being, you know, can I say about being a family? Can we talk about being a global family? Can we be that corny?
Well, I mean, I definitely, you know, I think there are quite a few elements of that in many striking different ways, really, because not only do we visit the home, you know, the present home of Oscar Ramirez, who, you know, for 15 years was a home of the undocumented, of someone who, from Central America, like so many others, who is here in the United States, fleeing the very context of violence that is decades long in Guatemala and is all too unfamiliar. Or familiar, I should say, in the surrounding region. So we're giving a context to the new home, right? And at the same time, in the film, we go and we visit, you know, similarly, the home that Oscar Ramirez had with this soldier who abducted him, and though it was a loving home, you know, it's quite the contrast to his previous home before that, which was this village of Dos Aires, which no longer even exists. I mean, it's literally a portrait through the absence of anything. These landscapes of this place that I've visited on multiple occasions, we've tried to visually depict the absence of the home and juxtapose that with some of the archive imagery we have of the, you know, more than 200 people, farmers, families, that lived in this place that's no longer there.
There's so many places I want to go with our conversation, and I think it's all going to come together. It seems to me, usually does, but it's going to seem maybe disconnected at points. But I love how you start even the credit sequence with the way. Can I use the word unredacted? Is that just I just made
yeah,
that up?
Yeah,
or
I
dis-
think I we made that up.
Yeah,
but, I don't know if that word existed before because I remember trying to explain to my sound designer how to come up with a sound for unredacting. And I think I got a spell check, you know, red line.
I bet you did. Yeah. I want to know what it spelled it as, you know, what it was trying to spell it as. Yeah. I haven't figured that out yet.
Redacting, I think is what it kept
doing. Yeah, probably. Probably. But I love the way you did that. I haven't seen that before, but it was really quite beautiful because, you know, as one of the, I think one of the, might have been the forensic anthropologist who said, you know, this is really about looking for the living. And there's this, what, which is again, back to home, back to humanity, back to others, you know, is truly this global village we live in. And I think that's one, another beautiful theme about your film. But I love the way right out of the gate you start, you go, no, this is about being human.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are a lot of historical elements to this film.
Yeah.
And the interaction with those historical elements, including these, you know, U.S. cables that were sent from the U.S. Embassy soon after this massacre took place, you know, of which, you know, we have this living record that within the State Department of the United States, there was this conversation going on that was explicitly acknowledging that this massacre had taken place and that they thought that the Guatemalan military was indeed responsible for killing all of these people. While nothing happened, there's no action that we can link to the government upon receiving these cables. It speaks to the importance of this documentation when it's revisited, when it becomes unclassified, and the idea of kind of pulling back,
right,
you know, the lack of transparency was at least how we wanted to at least visually depict that on the screen. And so that's where we came up with this idea of you know, pulling back the black Sharpie marker, so to speak. And we worked with a really amazing motion graphics designing company called The Glossary, who took that note, that idea of mine, and really seamlessly worked it in throughout the film in a lot of other places that I would have never even had thought, including the opening title.
Right, right.
I think it just says that we're gonna peel back here, and we're going to kind of take a look at what was previously, you know, non-transparent.
Well, it talks about evidence. It's about mystery. It's about the reveal. There's so many things, but what I truly love about it is it's how you reveal most of the men and women who work in the film. So that's you. So you reveal all these people, right? So it's no longer just a black magic marker. It's no longer just a line through a dark. No, this is a real person we're talking about here. This is what this film is really all about.
Yeah, and these real people, I mean, particularly how we tried to introduce both the victims and the perpetrators. I mean, here's an isolated event that took place 35 years ago in a very rural part of northern Guatemala. And yet to go and film the firsthand interviews with these people who were involved on both ends of this massacre, It took us all over North and Central America, including to Winnipeg, Canada, where one of the victims has been living in asylum for many years now, Ramiro. And so it just shows the tentacles of this story in just seeing these people are amongst us throughout. It doesn't matter which country borders, you know, you're defined by. So we very much wanted to take where we could take these interview subjects and get them out of the interview chair, so to speak, and film with them in public places where we could to hopefully visually communicate that idea that, you know, we're shoulder to shoulder with people whose histories we have no idea about, and some of them are incredibly harrowing, both as victims and perpetrators.
What do you learn, you know, just the way you tease that out about sort of the perpetrator and the victim living amongst us? What do you learn about the banality of evil? Or what do you just learn about evil?
Well, for me, I learned a lot when I sat down to interview these two soldiers who had come forward and ended up testifying and breaking this code of silence, which was remarkable in and of itself.
It really is, yeah.
It had not been done, really, in Guatemala.
Have you considered working for the FBI, Ryan? Or?
Well, I don't get to take credit for being the ones that coerced such an incredible testimony. I mean, this story, not only had there been these trials that had taken place prior to us making this film, but this story had already appeared in an amazing ProPublica piece in print, as well as This American Life did a radio piece here, and collectively they both were honored with the Peabody. So that, you know, it was proven that the story was pretty compelling, both in print and in radio. Though I think it's at its heart a very visual story, and that gets back to your question about evil. In the previous tellings of this story, I had an idea of what to expect in speaking to these two soldiers who had previously testified in these landmark cases in Guatemala, as well as participated in these previous iterations of the story. And I was preparing myself to sit down across from evil incarnate
Right.
something, some variation thereof.
Sure. Yep.
And the very minute a human being sat across from me, that idea was immediately challenged, and reminded me of the power of visual storytelling, because once you put that person in front of the camera, for me it reminded me that we're all human beings, and there is no such thing as just good and evil or black and white, and that there is most likely quite the potential within any of us under the right circumstances to do great good or to do great evil. And then in that, no way, you know, removes the culpability of these soldiers for what they were involved with. But I think it gave me a greater empathy, certainly a greater desire to understand how they got involved with what they ended up doing. Because if we don't, I think that's when we're more than likely going to be, you know, at a failure to truly understand why this continues to happen over and over. This is not an isolated incident of evilness appearing within the human species, but rather yet another example of human beings doing incredibly awful things.
Well, it's pretty interesting that was it July 1994 when some of this starts to come to a head.
Around then is when the peace talks were finally kind of taking root,
which is
and then the exhumation process was also happening when this human rights activist was kind of leading the charge to go and try to find these missing bodies.
Which is just post and, well, frankly, still kind of in the middle of the Rwandan genocide. So, right? And we're not too, from the time of this happening, we're not too far off the Cambodian genocide. And so, you know, what is it, about 100 million we've killed in the 20th century as human beings, one another? Isn't it remarkable what we can do to other human beings? Do you think, Ryan, you know, all the people you met, you interviewed, you're sitting across from the perpetrators, victims, and so on, profound moments of, I would imagine, anger and hatred and probably reconciliation and forgiveness as well. Do we change? Like, are things, you know, you talked about hope right out of the gate. I'm pretty hopeful. I'm a bit of a hopeful cynic. But boy, you watch a film like this and you go, wow, do we ever learn?
Well, I think if I find hope in this story, I find it from those human rights activists and those, you know, anthropologists and
right.
and really those people in civil society in Guatemala who demanded
right.
and refused to back down for decades with no real certainly no precedent
right.
that real justice or the impunity that continues to reign in
yep.
many ways in Guatemala but certainly did so in an unprecedented way was going to that they were going to overcome that. I mean, at its heart, the hope that they were hanging on to was just literally finding the bodies, the skeletons,
right.
the remains of their loved ones, and to try to bring closure for those families and communities that were affected.
Well, you're
about a base level of hope. What you're looking for,
sure. Yeah,
and something. So many, I think, particularly in Western society, just doesn't have any point of reference to what it's like to have hope in those kind of circumstances.
I love the woman that you spoke to. Was her name Aura?
Aurelina Farfan.
Yeah, and she talked about the mother who was 99 and how she was still waiting.
Mm-hmm.
She
for
was
her, yeah. So her brother is disappeared. I mean, talk about just a. If there is such a thing as evil, I mean, it's an evil tactic, to say the least, to disappear people. And the Guatemalan government, in addition to these massacres that took place primarily in the rural areas of the country, the government also disappeared roughly 40,000 people, and those took place more often in the cities. And those could be union leaders, they could be professors, journalists, anyone that the government thought was potentially a threat to their power. I just met at a screening at Berkeley last week a gentleman who was a student leader during this time, and five of his peers were disappeared and have never been found.
Wow.
And it's you know, for these families involved, not only are they mourning most likely the death of their loved one, but they're never afforded the closure of knowing what actually happened, of being able to give that loved one a proper burial, and also the cruelty of this hope pendulum that maybe they are
right.
indeed still alive and they're still out there, and every day that they don't come back, you pull back that scab and you have to grieve that loss again. And so it was a tactic that was employed in a way to really try to devastate those that would be a threat to the government's power.
Do you define truth or justice or evidence any differently? Those are three very big questions, but differently post, you know, you're still in kind of the experience of the film, I would imagine, and, you know, the Q&As and the people that you're meeting and so on, and articles and interviews and all of that. But you know, I guess what's changed about how you see the world, I guess, is the bigger question.
Well, that's it. I mean,
it's a doozy. I know. And you don't even have.
I mean, I'm going to start with the truth and justice aspect.
Well, yeah, because at one point, I think in the film, I think, again, it's back to the anthropologist, and I would expect somebody to say, you know, somebody like this to say this, but I think he said something about the evidence is going to lead us to truth and justice. And that really caught my ear, you know, from a philosophical background. I'm not totally sure that's true, but I know what he meant.
Well, I think if the film could have been called anything other than Finding Oscar, it could have been called Finding Truth.
Right.
And for me, one thing I've really learned in the making of this film is this idea of justice. I think I like many, I imagine, think of justice as almost purely a transactional courtroom process of bringing those who are charged with whatever crimes to court and hopefully prevailing and them going and serving some prison term or something of consequence.
Sure.
And the idea that justice actually has many different faces or has many different elements is something that I very much learned on a whole nother level in telling the story, because for more than a couple decades, these activists and anthropologists and the like have been engaged in this incredible effort to find the missing and to try and make these families and communities whole, and yet they did so also in an incredibly detailed way that, so hopefully someday maybe that could be used as evidence in a courtroom. But what they were, I think, searching for and striving for was this idea of an acknowledgement of the truth, I think, which is all the more kind of relevant,
right,
and timely in the world of today, this idea of facts and this idea of what is true. But when you're operating within a decades-long civil war of sorts, and you have propagandist efforts that are really trying to cloud for the people what's actually happening, and who's guilty of what, these communities that are affected by this, who have lost loved ones, who know this pain and this trauma, just for them to see a public acknowledgement of what actually happened to them, what actually happened to their loved ones, for that to be acknowledged in the context of a society where the government didn't acknowledge the Truth Commission that was forged out of the peace accords in 1996, there was a Truth Commission that happened. And the government of Guatemala, who were still the same officials in power previous to the peace accords, many of them with ties to the military, they never acknowledged that Truth Commission. And so just the idea that justice can be truth, or justice can be an acknowledgement of the truth, that for me, it was a powerful idea that I think many in Guatemala, and hopefully this film itself is a version thereof, to go and bring their story not only to countries far and wide, but also within their own country.
Right.
So, there are many people in Guatemala who have no idea that this took place in their own lifetime in their country. And students today in schools, this is a chapter that's not taught. There is no acknowledgement that any of this has taken place. And so you have a society that's still grappling with the idea of acknowledging its own truth. And I think therein lies a version of the justice that many there are yearning for.
Well, I think before we had the recorder even rolling, I think, or started, I think your comment was these stories, these types of stories, they deserve an audience. And I think what I take from what you just said is there's all kinds of different audiences here we're talking about. We're talking about, internal, external. We're talking about academic. We're talking about, right? I mean, this is a story that needs to be told for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, I mean, this is a story that I didn't know anything about before it walked into my office one day.
Right.
I never been to Central America before making this film. And even though I knew it was a pretty conflict-ridden region in the 70s and 80s, and that maybe the U.S. government, had some culpability in that, I certainly didn't know the details. And so I've received an incredible education personally in the last few years, and we've certainly tried to tell this film and this story in a way to a somewhat similar audience of unknowing and unassuming North Americans, so that hopefully it gets outside of the echo chamber of those in the choir who are all too familiar of what's taking place. I mean, there's plenty of people in North America who know all too well this story, many of which are from Central America. But I think there's a large population, and myself included, that didn't know that this happened, didn't know our government had a real role in it, and I think it provides an incredible context for why so many Guatemalans, particularly here in Los Angeles, where we have more Guatemalans in this city than any city in the world outside of Guatemala City. And there are so many Hondurans and El Salvadorians and Central Americans throughout, not just Southern California, but North America as a whole. And it's this context. And if we can understand this context, I think that puts a human face on this issue, not only of immigration, but also the consequences of foreign policy. And certainly those kind of issues are important and timeless in and of their own right. But at this particular time, I think are even more important to be discussing.
I definitely want to go down that foreign policy route in a second here, but I'd love to ask you a question about memory and just remembering what happened and how it happened. You know, upwards close to 200,000 civilians dead, I believe, over this period, this civil war. My experience of Cambodia and the Khmer Rouge and over the years of having worked in the country, I've met a lot of people, I think, who would say, "Boy, I just wish this would go away. Like, we really don't need the trials. You know, it's just, oh, it's bringing it all back to the surface. And, you know, we're really never going to get reconciliation anyway." Do you buy any of that?
I mean, I think I can understand it to the level that I can understand the desire to kind of to move forward, regardless of which political persuasion you may or may not have.
Sure.
Within the region that's kind of dealing with this. Certainly those who have some culpability would probably prefer to turn the chapter sooner.
Of course.
Those who have experienced the consequences of that. But I don't claim to fully understand the best way to reconcile these things. Like, at the end of the day, reconciliation is absolutely necessary if there's going to be meaningful progress moving forward as a collective. And so threading the needle on that balance, I think is something that's, you know, is incredibly tricky, and I think is a reason why a lot of societies have failed to successfully charter a path forward after something like this happened within their country. I would say within Guatemala, it's a far cry from feeling like they can actually move forward when so much of this has never even been acknowledged in the first place.
Right.
Because that just feels like a revisionist history then, which, you know, for those that were that have been affected, of which in this case we're talking about not just a couple hundred thousand people directly murdered by their own government, but how many hundreds of thousands more family members and loved ones who forever have had their lives marked by this, to ask them to just change the chapter, to move forward and never even acknowledge what happened here. I think that's a tall order to then ask them to come to the table.
I don't know how you can trust anyone, never mind political leaders. I don't know how you can really truly trust family members who aren't willing to put it on the table, if you know what I mean. You know, let's just sweep our past under the carpet and ignore it and move on. Well, hang on a minute. I'm not sure I'm getting into that boat.
It feels all a little too convenient, and certainly seems to be. Again, I don't claim to be an expert in this within Guatemala or outside of it, but it seems to be an idea that is often proposed by those who it would be in their best interest to just move forward and not have to
just to really let it go.
Kind of live in the pain of acknowledging what this is and what sort of consequences that acknowledgement might entail.
So I think the line was,
I mean, it was a long, I'm looking for it here in my notes, but there was a complicity by omission was the line. Where's the, a tacit participant, you know, back to your comment about foreign policy and where we're heading today and getting involved in other countries. On one level, it seems like, you know, and here's the Canadian on this side over here, you know, speaking about, you know, issues that I don't know a great deal about either, but what does it tell us today? You know, so here's this government at the time that was coming alongside the military in Guatemala at the time, and essentially, I mean, some of the shots you have of Reagan are, frankly, you know, openly admiring him, you know, the leader at the time, pretty disturbing stuff.
Yeah, and all courtesy of the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library,
which is pretty funny.
The public and is a beautiful resource for documentarians when telling a story like this. To be able to, we sent our researcher Alexandra Bowen, and she spent quite a bit of time there and unearthing this incredible imagery, not just stills and contact sheets, but also video of where you're seeing, you know, the leader of the free world stand with a dictator who took over in a military coup not even a year prior, of which many, you know, within the human rights communities were trying to sound the alarm on this scorched earth campaign and these, you know, these massacres that were taking place well in advance of the Dos Aires massacre. And there's Ronald Reagan standing with this guy, calling him a defender of democracy, and that he has our support 2 days before this incredibly, you know, elite special forces group known as the Caibiles enter into this community of really farmers, peaceful farmers, and rape and pillage and murder everyone there, with the exception of these two young boys who are abducted. You know, the message communicated when President Reagan stands there with a dictator and says he has our support and is a defender of democracy, I think is a message that certainly is not lost on that dictator,
right?
If not others like him. And so, you know, for a region that has already had its own impunity for so long, To have that impunity then extend internationally beyond its own borders in that way, I think can have the gravest of consequences.
Well, it just, you know, it's so easy to throw stones, to point the finger and to say, well, it's your fault. And you know, isn't this really about, in some regards, isn't living a full life, and I say a small F, about shirking our responsibility to others, right? Who gives a rat's ass about my neighbor, right? But aren't we all in some way tacit participants? And I guess that's what I kind of pulled from that, you know, and how does that actually play out in our own communities and our own freedom and sense of responsibility to absolutely to our families, but to our neighbors and to others around the world, as, you know, kind of connected in a way to your comment about, you know, these stories deserve audiences.
Listen, I mean, I think it's a slippery slope. The more you learn about these things, the more you become aware of your own culpability as a citizen of the these governmental entities. We empower these governments, and so if we're the citizens who are supposedly holding them accountable or not holding them accountable,
right,
and our taxpaying dollars are going to the bombs that are being dropped on people in far off places, then we do indeed own some of that responsibility. And I think it's, you know, I don't think it's a mistake that, or an accident, that people tend to avoid learning these sorts of truths that put themselves in an uncomfortable position to have to then figure out how to navigate the world moving forward if you have to take some ownership for really awful things happening to other people, you know, for what is justified as something that's making your life supposedly better or safer or more comfortable. And that's certainly not singled out just in foreign policy of warfare, but that's an idea that you know, goes into our consumerism, goes into the types of food that we eat, and you know, the clothes that we wear, and the ramifications of just being a consumer, much less a citizen. Mm. And I think it's also the reason why a lot of folks tend to try and stay clear of learning these things that
right.
you can't forget after you learn them. And you know, it's an important story, but I almost shirk at the idea of calling it an important story because I fear it puts it in a category of stories that people go out of their way to avoid because of fear that what those important stories mean.
Right.
And I think there's no greater sin in the documentary world than, I mean, maybe there's greater sins, but I definitely think it's, you know, we often hear of important stories, and I think it's really on the filmmaker when they expect an audience to watch something because it's important.
Well, yeah, because now I'm going to be leaving. I'm leaving the theater with.
You need to. You have to tell these stories in a compelling way if
right.
you want to compete with the never-ending supply of things competing for our time and energy
sure.
and resources. And so, as a storyteller, to have an incredible story like Oscar Ramirez's story, this very intimate and personal story that allows us to touch upon much, much larger contextual issues like foreign policy and immigration and genocide, that's really, for me, the attraction to this particular story, because I feel like it's a point of access. It's a way in to tell a great story, but also, you know, impart an education on an unsuspecting audience.
Well, it's, you know what, and I don't know if for what it's worth, and we've never met, sadly, but it is an important film, but it's also a beautiful film, Ryan. I mean, it is a story not only worth telling, but it's a story worth hearing about. And yes, there is going to be a certain your responsibility meter in your own world is going to be recalibrated. I won't deny that, but I think you're also. I think you're going to come out of this theater. You're going to watch this film, and you are going to be potentially a better person.
Well, we certainly hope we start a conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
The best films, the best documentaries for me are the ones that kind of they dig in under your skin a little bit, you know, and you say things like I never knew that happened, or I didn't know about that, and lead you into either an explicit conversation with perhaps the people who you've seen the film with or those you come home to, or you do the Google dive.
Exactly right. And the reality is these kinds of things, it seems to me, these kinds of things are cumulative. I mean, this could be the seed that's planted with many different people, that's watered over time, that's watered over years. These are the kinds of stories you hear about where, oh, you know, I was this age and I saw this film and it changed, you know, the direction I took. I mean, I'm largely in development today in a way, you could say, by, you know, reading Stephen Lewis's book, Race Against Time, and Romeo Dallaire's book, Shake Hands with the Devil. And I was at a time in my career philosophically, and I just kind of started to go down this ethical route and wrote, and it largely had to do with these two stories, you know. And so I think that's profoundly beautiful about everything we do, about the splash and ripple effect, but I think it's brilliant with respect to, you know, documentary film and films like yours. Why do you come out of this, and we're going to have to wrap this up in a second here or two, but why do you come out of this with a sound of hope still in your voice? Because I think I can hear it.
Well, yeah, that gets back to your larger question of what's my worldview.
That's right. Come on, Ryan. I mean, really, what is your worldview?
I mean, I was probably a romantic optimist before
okay.
I really dug into this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'd say I'm more of a optimistic realist.
Right.
And I think that you know, if I'm anything, I'm pragmatic, and so I feel like I can't not unlearn the fact that the horrors that I had to really dig into pretty deep in really trying to understand this story and the devastating reality that these are not an anomaly within Guatemala. much less an anomaly in Central or Latin America or the world at large, it gives me considerable pause in just contemplating what our species is.
Yeah.
And our ever all too soon reoccurring actions against each other in this way. And yet, I'm a father of a couple young daughters, and not only did that probably open my empathy well to a whole different level in telling a story of which incredibly horrific things happen, not only to these two young boys who were abducted, but the many, many other children under the age of 12 who were executed at those various. I see in my own children the very, I think, inherent beauty of our species and of life.
Nice.
The potential and the hope, you know, that is very much manifested in them in so many ways for me personally, and I think just in a global idea. And so I'm committed to trying to myself make the world a slightly better place than I found it, and tell stories like this that hopefully, you know, not only dig in under the skin a little bit, but if they leave you changed in any way for the better, then that's certainly been worth the time and energy.
There's a beautiful line, and I'm pretty sure it was Oscar who said, quote, "I wasn't expecting to be the person they were looking for." I laughed out loud when I heard that, and I just thought, isn't that kind of not only an affirmation of that hope and that potential and that opportunity, you know, freedom, choice, responsibility, but also the idea that, hey, we can maybe change. There is this, you know, splash and ripple effect actually makes contact with reality each and every day.
It's true. And, you know, we find heroes in the least likely places and certainly those who are not expecting to be heroes, you know, and certainly Oscar learning this, you know, what could be defined as an existential sort of truth or crisis of finding out your whole life is a lie of sorts is probably the least likely candidate to also to be the hero. And I think it's a reminder that, you know, we're never expecting that phone call. We're never expecting that moment necessarily. But when it comes, if and when it comes, how we respond to it, it's more how we respond to it than what it is that is going to define, you know, whether we're heroic in it or not.
Well, Ryan, thanks for your time today. We're talking about a new film called Finding Oscar. Ryan Safern here with us today. FindingOscar.com. Is that right, Ryan?
That's correct. Yeah, you can kind of find out all about the theatrical release, of which we're in the midst of right now. It's not playing in Canada just yet, but hopefully
could be soon.
The theaters see you soon, and yeah, that'd be great.
Finding Oscar. It's a film that the Hollywood Reporter has called an absorbing documentary about an unlikely survival story, and that's just not even the half of it. Ryan, thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it. It's been a real pleasure. And again, congratulations on a beautiful film and a hopeful film and a really engaging story. I love the way you told it.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned, We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.